So, as Stephen said, I'm here to talk about the first Elizabeth, who makes, I think, every other queen a sort of pale imitation, except our present queen. I ought to be loyal, really, as we're coming up to the Jubilee weekend. And it's quite interesting to compare the two Elizabeths. On the surface, they had absolutely nothing in common apart from their name. You have the Virgin Queen, and you have the Mother of Four. You have the great sort of PR strategist, very public woman, and then you have the very private woman in Elizabeth II. You have the flamboyant, flirtatious Elizabeth I and the rather more staid and conservative Elizabeth II. But when you dig more deeply, actually, these two queens have got quite a lot of important things in common. They were both almost exactly the same age on their accession in their mid-20s, so both very young to become Queen of England. They're both very much governed by a sense of duty and an incredible discipline and dedication to their role. So actually, I think there's an enormous amount of common ground between these two women. But I'm not really going to explore that anymore, except just to preface it, because, of course, this is a Jubilee event, so it would have been rude not to mention our present Queen. But what I really want to do is take us back now and look at that first Elizabeth, as Stephen so rightly said, the trailblazer who set the standards that all other queens had to follow. And my book, I thought I was going to have to do a shameless plug for it, but actually I've sold quite a decent number already, so I'll save you that. But my book focuses on the women in Elizabeth's life, because actually when you read about Elizabeth and when you see her in films and on television series, it's usually her relationships with men that predominate. Of course, there's the endless speculation about her relationship with Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, and the question that I'm always asked at lectures, so I'm going to sort of prevent that now by saying it, is, was Elizabeth really a virgin? And indeed, if you'd actually bothered to listen to Woman's Hour this morning, I was asked that question on Woman's Hour, but you're going to have to read my book if you want to know the answer as to whether Elizabeth was really a virgin, so sorry about that. But endless speculation about Elizabeth and men, and Elizabeth herself fostered this image, because she was always, she was a great flirt, she liked to surround herself by the male courtiers, and she was the queen bee, really, in the hive of the court. And she also was quite critical of her own sex, so she wasn't a great feminist at the time, even though obviously her example proved that women could rule just as effectively as men. But Elizabeth herself pretended to regret that she was a mere woman, I think in order to carve out a place for herself in what was really very much a man's world. And she famously said, "I have the body of a weak and female, weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king." And she was always talking about herself in male terms, but really, don't be fooled, because Elizabeth was every bit as confident in her femininity as future female sovereigns would be. So I did my research on Elizabeth. I studied Elizabeth for my PhD, and I'm afraid I sort of went the way of many other historians and looked at Elizabeth and the men in her life. And actually, it was only many years later, after I'd left the sort of academic scene, that I thought about coming at Elizabeth's life from a new angle, which is quite difficult, actually, because Elizabeth is so written about. But I was interested in her relationships with women and what that would say about this great, iconic queen, whether it would give a different insight into her. And I think it's amazing how much more human Elizabeth appears when you explore her relationships with the key women in her life, from her mother, Anne Boleyn, through to her half-sister Mary, her great rival Mary, Queen of Scots, and the women at her court. They reveal a very different Elizabeth, as I hope you'll agree by the end of this talk. And I'm just going to give you sort of a few highlights, I hope they're highlights, of the women I've written about, because there are 30 in the book. And I don't want to keep you that long from the canapes and the refreshments. So I'm only going to sort of pick a few of the most crucial women in Elizabeth's life. Beginning, of course, with her mother, Anne Boleyn. Well, Anne Boleyn was not a popular lady, and indeed she still causes controversy amongst historians today. It's kind of a love-hate relationship that they tend to have with Anne. But at the time, she was reviled by the English population because she'd supplanted the very popular first wife of Henry VIII, Catherine of Aragon. Now, Catherine had had a very good marriage with Henry, despite, you know, what we now know would happen later. She'd had a very good marriage for the first few years. She'd given Henry a daughter, but crucially, she'd failed to give him a son, and that's why Henry started to cast about for another wife, and his eyes soon fell upon the beautiful, alluring Anne Boleyn. She'd been raised in the French court. That gave her a certain advantage in cultural terms over the many English ladies at court. And she soon beguiled the king, Henry VIII. But she was very clever, was Anne, because Henry was quite renowned for taking mistresses, but Anne refused to become Henry's mistress, and she held him at bay for 7 years, which was quite an achievement if you knew all the escapades that Henry VIII used to get up to. And Anne, really, I think from the very beginning, had her eyes on the great prize. If you want to get ahead, get a ring, is what Anne probably had as her motto, something I failed in, actually, myself. And Anne very quickly gained sort of notoriety at court because everybody was speculating about whether she really was the king's mistress, but in fact, she wasn't. But Henry was deeply in love with her, and he ended up by overturning the entire religious establishment of England in order to divorce his first wife and to marry Anne. Well, he did so in 1533, and if you do the math, then Anne was actually already pregnant by that time. She'd given in at the last moment, I think, and she was already pregnant by the time she married Henry in 1533. And it was in the August of that year that she entered her confinement. Now, in those days, royal ladies, and indeed many aristocratic ladies, would go into a sort of birthing chamber or a series of rooms known as the birthing chamber about 4 weeks before their child was due. And during that 4 weeks, they could be surrounded and served only by women. No man was allowed to corrupt the atmosphere of these rooms, and neither was any light allowed in to the birthing chamber. So what they did was they hung heavy tapestries on the walls. They even stuffed the keyholes with material to stop any chink of light coming through. Windows were obviously closed. And even though it was one of the hottest Augusts on record, they, for good measure, lit fires in every room. So poor old Anne, you can imagine, she was in this miserable kind of chamber for 4 weeks before the birth of her child. And to make her misery even greater, she learned during those 4 weeks that her husband had been seeking entertainment elsewhere, should we say. He had a new love at court. So Anne was really miserable. She was, you know, obviously very uncomfortable anyway in the late stages of pregnancy. And in early September, she went into labour. And now what she'd done was to get Henry to marry her by promising him a son. But the child who was born on the 7th of September, 1533, was a girl. Now, this was a catastrophe. Henry had gone to such great lengths to marry Anne, and now she'd just given him another useless girl. Girls didn't count in the 16th century, or so we thought. And this spelled disaster for Anne, although it's easy to overplay that, because, of course, she was still young, she'd had a healthy child, and she may indeed have more. And in one of the most tactless remarks ever to be made by a new father, Henry came into the birthing chamber and took one look at Elizabeth and said, "Well, hopefully we'll have a boy next time." Not a comment that many men would get away with today, I don't think, if they were confronting their wives. So Elizabeth's birth was, you know, a disaster, really, for Anne, because, in fact, she would go on to have several miscarriages but have no more children. And by 1536, Henry had well and truly tired of Anne, and her enemies at court had concocted this controversy that claimed that Anne had been unfaithful to her husband with not one but five men, including her own brother, George Boleyn. So it was a real character assassination on the part of her enemies. And Anne was executed in May 1536. And this immediately had a very devastating effect on her young daughter, Elizabeth. Now, Elizabeth was only 2 years and 8 months old when her mother was executed. But even though, of course, in today's terms, you would think, well, that's going to have, you know, a horrific effect. Well, it was slightly tempered by the fact that Elizabeth didn't live at court. She'd been sent off to Hatfield House at the age of just 3 months with an enormous retinue of women. So she'd been born into this world of women, and she was served by a predominantly female household, including four women whose job was to do nothing more than to rock her cradle. Nice work if you can get it in the Tudor period. So Elizabeth had been at Hatfield for some time. She'd had some contact with her mother because Anne, you know, was devoted to her young daughter, and she would send her, you know, beautiful dresses and made-to-measure gowns, because in those days they dressed children as miniature adults, really. So from a very early age, Elizabeth would have been in the sort of bodices and full skirts that the older ladies at court would wear. So Elizabeth certainly knew her mother, but it wasn't such a close relationship as we would expect today. But nevertheless, Anne's execution had an absolutely prolific effect on Elizabeth, because it rendered her illegitimate, because Henry, her father, had divorced Anne, or at least proclaimed the marriage null and void before Anne's execution. So this effectively made Elizabeth merely a lady, not a princess. And she was very quick to appreciate this change in her status. And it's really sad when you read the household accounts of Elizabeth at Hatfield, because as well as this hugely important political aspect to her mother's execution, there was also the day-to-day matter of what Elizabeth would wear, because Henry had so far forgotten his youngest daughter that he stopped sending an allowance for her clothes, and so her lady mistress was forced to write to the court begging for new clothes for the poor Lady Elizabeth, who had outgrown all of her old ones. So Elizabeth learned very soon on that it was a very dangerous business indeed to be married at the Tudor court, and I think her mother's example was incredibly significant in Elizabeth's later life. She definitely decided at an early age that she would never marry, and it wasn't just because of Anne. As we all know, she had rather a few stepmothers after Anne, and they mostly came to quite sticky ends. There was Catherine Howard, of course, who was also executed on charges of adultery. Jane Seymour was the one who directly followed Anne Boleyn, and she died soon after giving birth to that much-longed-for male heir. But the other two stepmothers, who I'd like to just focus on briefly, had a much more positive impact on Elizabeth than to just convince her that marriage was a dangerous business. And they were Anne of Cleves and Catherine Parr. Now, Anne is the much maligned sort of ugly one, really. She was known as the Flanders Mare, which allegedly Henry called her, although, of course, he was no oil painting himself by the time he married her. He stayed married to her for as short a time as possible. He literally just went through with the marriage ceremony before having it very rapidly annulled because he just couldn't stand the sight of Anne. And Anne was, I think, one of the most successful of Henry's wives, because rather than being like the admirable but perhaps overly principled Catherine of Aragon, she gave Henry immediately what he wanted. She didn't hold out for the marriage. She just said, yeah, absolutely, I'll divorce you, and promptly was given five palaces and £30,000 a year, which even today, actually, is not to be sniffed at. So, really, this was quite a successful settlement on Anne's part, and she was then welcomed back to court. She was known as the King's sister. There was even rumours that Henry had actually come to love Anne and would remarry her, although, of course, that never happened. But what Anne did was she became very close to the young Elizabeth. And I think the main influence that she had on Elizabeth was to teach the young girl the value of being pragmatic. As I said, she hadn't really held out for any principled view about her rights as Henry's wife. She'd given him the divorce, and she did it for very sound political reasons, as well as to hold on to her head, as she didn't want to follow Anne Boleyn's example. And I think Elizabeth learned an enormous amount from Anne, but perhaps even more from her final stepmother, Catherine Parr, who is often seen as Henry's sort of nursemaid because he married her so late in his reign. Now, Catherine was the only queen of Henry to act as regent on his behalf, and this was enormously influential on Elizabeth because she was at court at the time that Catherine was acting as regent, and so she saw Catherine really being served as a queen in her own right, as a woman ruling a largely male court. And all these male courtiers would come to Catherine and present their petitions on bended knee. She'd be served by male attendants. And this was enormously significant in Elizabeth's development. And it seems from that time forward, she started to believe that one day she too might be served as queen, but not queen consort, as queen regnant. Well, she had a little while to wait because, as well as her half-sister Mary, Elizabeth had a brother, Edward, who also became Edward VI. And, of course, because he was a boy, he inherited the throne when Henry VIII died in 1547. But the great irony is that Henry had gone to all this trouble to get a son, and Edward only lasted for 6 years. He died very young, and, in fact, he'd had people ruling for him because he'd ascended the throne at only a very young age. But his reign was short-lived. He was followed by Mary, known as Bloody Mary, because she put so many Protestants to the flame. Now, Mary had the most fascinating relationship with her half-sister, Elizabeth. It's often seen as a very hostile relationship, and for good reason, but actually it didn't start that way. There was more depth to the half-sister's relationship than that, because Mary was some 16 years older than Elizabeth and actually became quite a mother figure to Elizabeth after Anne Boleyn's execution. She was incredibly kind to her and helped in her studies and helped to sort of mediate between Elizabeth and Henry VIII and remind their father that actually he did have another daughter as well. So Elizabeth had cause to be very grateful to Mary, and indeed they were close as Elizabeth grew into adulthood. But what really changed things was when Mary became queen, because very soon on, early on in Mary's reign, she started to whip up opposition to her regime by this sort of dogmatic religious policy of stamping out any opponents to her attempt to re-establish the Roman Catholic faith that her father had got rid of, but also by her lack of sort of charisma. She wasn't really great at being in touch with the popular mood. And worst of all by Mary was the mistake of marrying a Spaniard, which in, you know, the Tudor period, that was just like marrying your most mortal enemy. And they were an incredibly xenophobic nation in the 16th century. So Mary very quickly became deeply unpopular with her subjects. By contrast, her beautiful, glamorous younger sister, Elizabeth, had every bit as much charisma, if not more, as their father, Henry. And the people adored her. She was the flame-haired Tudor princess. And it wasn't just her looks and her charisma. It was her attitude to politics and to religion. She was much more of a moderate. She was willing to tolerate all beliefs. She famously said that she did not wish to make windows into men's souls, and that was carried out in all of her actions when she was indeed queen. So very soon, Elizabeth became this focus for the opponents to Mary's regime, and this put her in an incredibly dangerous position because various plots and rebellions were staged all in Elizabeth's name, even though I don't think she had any knowledge of any of them. And of course, Mary had to do something about this situation. She couldn't just have her sister as this threat. So she put her under arrest. She was in the Tower several times during Mary's reign. And it was said that on one occasion, Mary had Elizabeth's death warrant in front of her and was hovering over it to sign it. And actually, then her conscience got the better of her, and she admitted that there wasn't enough concrete evidence to put her sister to death. So Elizabeth survived. I think she's one of history's greatest survivors, actually, when you look at what she'd endured through her early years in particular. And she herself became queen finally in 1558, when her sister had no other choice but to leave the throne to her because she didn't have any direct heirs of her own. So Elizabeth ascended the throne on a wave of popularity, far more than had been seen for either of her siblings, because she was mature, she was, as I say, she'd got the sort of physical graces, she got the charisma, and she set herself up as being, you know, tolerant and popular, really. She was very much in touch with what her subjects wanted. But it didn't last, because very soon on in Elizabeth's reign, she started to suffer at the hands of rivals, and those rivals tended to be of royal blood, and they also tended to be women. It's quite an irony, really, that it's the sort of the threats to a regime are so often seen in male terms in the Tudor period, but really, Elizabeth's deadliest enemies were all women, and there was none more deadly than Mary, Queen of Scots, Elizabeth's great rival. Now, I do talk about their relationship in my book, but you could write an entire book just about Elizabeth and Mary, and indeed entire books have been written, and with good cause, because it's fascinating. They were opposites in just about every way. When you look at Mary's upbringing, in contrast to this kind of school of hard knocks that Elizabeth had been raised in, Mary had been the pampered princess. She'd been raised in the French court primarily. She'd been taught to believe that everything she did was marvellous, that, you know, there was no real sort of cruelty in the world. She had no political guile or acumen, in great contrast to Elizabeth. But the fundamental difference between these two women was that Elizabeth ruled with the head and Mary with the heart, and with disastrous consequences, because probably Mary's worst move was to marry the man who was the chief suspect in the murder of her previous husband, which really wasn't a good move. But it was quite a personal sort of animosity between the two women. It wasn't just the fact that Mary constituted a threat because she was of royal blood and she was Roman Catholic. It was more than that. I think Elizabeth had a genuine sort of jealousy of Mary, a genuine kind of hostility towards her on very personal terms. And you can see this in the letters that passed between Elizabeth and her Scottish ambassador, because as well as asking him to, you know, suss out what was going on in Scottish political affairs, she also asked him to report back, you know, is Mary really that beautiful as her reputation suggests? She was said to charm anybody who came within, you know, a mile radius of her. Is she really that beautiful? And how tall is Mary, by the way? Elizabeth wanted to know. And her ambassador was on a bit of a sticky wicket with these questions, and so wrote back, she is tall, Your Grace. And Elizabeth quizzed him further, well, is she taller than me? And so he wrote back, well, yes, she is taller than me. So Elizabeth spat back, then she's too tall. So she hated the fact that Mary had this upper hand over her, and you can really see that sort of personal element to their relationship. Well, as I said, Mary ruled with the heart and made a disastrous marriage to Bothwell, who had very probably put her second husband, Darnley, to death. And Mary was pretty soon kicked out of her kingdom. The nobles rebelled against her successfully. They staged a coup, and Mary was forced to flee to safety. This was another moment of bad choice on Mary's part, because instead of actually going across the channel to France, where she had many friends still from her early days there, she decided to go just south of the border to England, which was an incredibly bad move. And I think she did that because, actually, when you read the letters that passed between these two women, you'd believe they were the best of friends. They called each other, you know, dear sister, even though obviously they weren't sisters, and, you know, my affectionate friend. And it was all very flowery terms. And I think, actually, Mary believed every word that Elizabeth wrote, which was a huge mistake. It was all sort of statecraft on Elizabeth's part. And the very first thing she did when Mary arrived on English soil was to put her in prison, or rather in honourable custody in a succession of houses in the north of England. And in fact, Mary would remain a prisoner for almost 20 years. And during that time, in fact, she actually became more dangerous to Elizabeth as a prisoner on English soil than she had been as a free woman in Scotland, because, of course, Elizabeth's enemies now had their focus even closer. She was on home soil, and many plots and rebellions sprang up against Elizabeth that aimed to assassinate Elizabeth and put Mary on the throne. And Mary wasn't as clever as Elizabeth at avoiding involvement in these plots, and eventually, probably driven by sheer desperation, she put her name to a letter in the infamous Babington conspiracy of 1586. And this gave Elizabeth's spies, created the network created by Walsingham, just enough ammunition to get Mary arrested, and indeed to draw up a death warrant for Mary, Queen of Scots. But even then, Elizabeth hesitated, because, you know, this was quite a big deal to put an anointed queen to death. And it was setting a very dangerous precedent. If she just signed it without thought, then surely somebody could have done the same to Elizabeth. So Elizabeth prevaricated. She made a great show of pretending not to know what to do with this traitorous queen who was in her own kingdom. But eventually, she did put her signature to Mary's death warrant, and Mary was executed at Fotheringay in 1587. And the very first thing Elizabeth did was to say, "Oh no, I didn't sign anything. Don't think so. No, I don't remember a death warrant. Was it? Oh, was it that? I didn't realise. Oh, I didn't know what I was signing. Sorry. I mean, they put so many papers in front of me that day. I didn't know it was a death warrant. They should have told me." Immediately put the blame on her poor secretary, William Davidson, for not pointing out that, in fact, this huge document with Mary, Queen of Scots, writ large, was actually Mary, Queen of Scots' death warrant. So Elizabeth, of course, was fooling nobody, but she made a great show of distancing herself from the act of executing her cousin Mary, Queen of Scots. And as I say, she did it for good reason, because she knew that she had brought the wrath of Catholic Europe upon her shoulders by executing Mary. And that is indeed exactly what happened, because in 1588, Philip II of Spain launched the Armada against England in the name of the executed Scottish Queen. But ironically, even though, you know, this looks like Mary's victory, in fact, Elizabeth had the last laugh, because this was the finest moment of her entire reign. It was pivotal. I mean, frankly, it was thanks to the English weather that she defeated the Armada. But, you know, it still gave her victory, and it didn't matter. And she gave this amazing speech at Tilbury. You know, I mentioned earlier about having the body of a weak and feeble woman. And she rallied her troops. And really, it was then, at that moment, that there's a beginning of a sense of national pride in England. And it was all thanks to the Armada and to the fact that Elizabeth was able to defeat it. And it was from that moment that the real cult of Elizabeth sprang up. She was Gloriana. She was the Virgin Queen. At last, after haggling with Elizabeth over her refusal to marry anybody, her ministers seemed to actually accept her decision to remain the Virgin Queen. And she made a virtue out of her virgin state, whether it was a real virgin state, as I say, I'm not going to give that away. But she made a virtue out of it by actually setting herself up as a kind of Virgin Mary here on earth for her subjects to worship. And this is when you get the introduction of the famous white makeup that Elizabeth always appears in. And she doesn't age. If you look at the portraits of her, there was this so-called mask of youth. But actually, it was clear to everybody at court as her reign progressed and in the sort of 1590s that Elizabeth could not keep up the pretense for much longer. And this is when you see quite a sad decline of Elizabeth's status. She starts to lose her grip on the affairs of her own court. And it's really not a fitting ending to her reign when you look at all the fantastic things that had gone before. But what you see in the 1590s is an increasing number of scandals amongst Elizabeth's ladies-in-waiting. And they were enormously significant, because before that time, Elizabeth had ruled her ladies with an iron rod. They hadn't been able to get away with anything. She knew exactly what was going on. But increasingly, she was losing her grip, and you get the scandals such as Bess Throckmorton secretly marrying Sir Walter Raleigh, Lettice Knowles secretly marrying Elizabeth's great favourite, Robert Dudley. The Earl of Essex got up to things that I can't repeat in a house of God. But it was just, it got worse and worse as the reign went on. And as I say, it was a real symbol of Elizabeth's declining authority over her court. And there's a really sad occasion that's reported when Elizabeth finally accepts herself that she is no longer the mistress of her male courtiers' affections. You know, they've paid homage to Gloriana for many years, but finally, Elizabeth was said to have called for a looking glass. She hadn't seen her reflection for many years. She'd avoided it. And then when she saw her face, as it was said, lean and full of wrinkles, she fell into such a deep melancholy and exclaimed against all those who'd ever claimed she was beautiful. And it was from this moment that there was a real decline in Elizabeth's health. In the early weeks of 1603, she retired to nearby here in Richmond, her favourite palace. It was known affectionately by her as her warm box, because it had an amazing central heating system, which was way ahead of its time. And Elizabeth retreated here significantly with her women. To the very end, she was surrounded by women. And these were not the flouting wenches, as Elizabeth called them, these women who'd sort of betrayed her and married in secret. These were her loyal servants who'd served Elizabeth throughout their lives, the likes of Blanche Parry and of Cat Astley, who died some years before. But those sort of women who were so loyal and had really set the benchmark for what was expected of a servant of Elizabeth. So she surrounded herself by this coterie of ladies, and they were with her till her last breath in March 1603, when she was said to have slipped from the tree of life like a ripe apple, quietly as a lamb, said her chaplain. Well, immediately after Elizabeth's death, a messenger was dispatched to Scotland, and the new king, James, who was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, perhaps indeed she had the last laugh, was proclaimed King of England and Scotland, the first joint ruler. Meanwhile, Elizabeth was continually attended, or her body was continually attended by her ladies. They watched over it as it was taken by barge from Richmond all the way to Whitehall. And then they continued to stand in a silent vigil around the coffin for 28 days until Elizabeth's funeral at the end of April. And it's said, according to one possibly scurrilous contemporary account, that Elizabeth, during that time, had one last surprise in store for her ladies, because on one of these sombre, very silent evenings, as they were watching over their mistress's coffin, there was suddenly a loud crack as Elizabeth's body burst the sides of the coffin open, and obviously to the horror of the ladies waiting by. Well, did this happen? I think possibly not. You'd be amazed at how many monarchs were said to have exploded in death in history. It's kind of almost a way, I think, of the next reign, the next ruler discrediting their predecessor. It's like, look, you know, they may have been a great queen, but actually they were just flesh and bone like everybody else. So it probably didn't happen, but I rather like the idea that maybe it did, and that maybe Elizabeth still had a hold over her women, even to her last breath. So, as Stephen said at the beginning, and I repeated, Elizabeth had been a trailblazer. And actually, it didn't take long for people to soon start to regret the passing of this great queen. James was by no means as successful. He was not as charismatic. His court was immoral. He didn't inspire the love and the devotion that Elizabeth had done. And so everybody started harking back to the glory days of Elizabeth. And indeed, she's retained that reputation for the following 400 years. And I think it's quite fitting that we now have a second Elizabeth on the throne, who has also proved enormously successful, another very long ruler, not 45 years, but as we know, 60 years. And I think Elizabeth II has a great deal to be thankful to her namesake for, because Elizabeth I had carved out an entirely new position for the Queens of England. Until her reign, it had been seen as an absolute disaster to have a woman as ruler. That's why Henry VIII had gone to so much trouble to get a son. And the great irony is that his most successful child had been not a son, but a daughter, Elizabeth I, who I think rightly has gone down in history as probably the greatest monarch we've ever had. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Tracy. And we've now got the opportunity for questions. And you're happy about this, yeah? To answer any questions at all?
Pretty much.
Apart from the Virgin one.
Well, I'm not answering that one.
Yeah, so you have to listen to iPlayer in a couple of days' time on the Women's Hour. We've got a roving mic here, and Jerry is quick off the mark with the first question. So, Jerry, if you just... I think it's on. Speaking
yes,
to that.
Yes, thank you. Is it true that at Richmond Palace, when Elizabeth died, that the ring was taken off her finger and thrown to the horseman? Now, who was the horseman?
It was Henry Carey, who was a descendant of Elizabeth's mother, Anne Boleyn, or rather her sister, Mary Boleyn. And it was Lady Scroope who dropped the ring. So that story is pretty well authenticated. And immediately that was a sign. If you had the ring of the reigning monarch, then you were the new king or queen.
Thank you. Okay, he was the one who rode to Scotland, was he? And
yes, yeah. Indeed.
Okay, just showing I know something. anyone else got another question? Over here, John.
Very intrigued by the idea that you suggested that Elizabeth made it very clear that she never wanted to be married.
Yes.
What kind of evidence, apart from the if you like, the psychological side of it, of seeing the impact of the fate of previous Tudor women who've been close to her, is there any documentary evidence about that?
There is. In fact, Elizabeth, when she was just 8 years old, was recorded as saying, "I will never marry," and she said that because she was prompted to do so by the execution of Catherine Howard. And I think the fact she'd had both a mother now and a stepmother executed for adultery just really made up Elizabeth's mind. But I think it was went beyond the sort of the personal and the political. I think Elizabeth had a really deep-seated fear of marriage, and it was quite a profound fear. It wasn't just, you know, the fact that love and politics are a dangerous mix. I think physically she was very afraid of childbirth. It was a very dangerous thing to give birth in the 16th century. Many women didn't survive. That's why the average life expectancy was only about 30 for a woman at that time. And so I think Elizabeth was frightened about that. She knew that the Tudors had a pretty bad track record where childbirth was concerned. But, of course, being the great sort of strategist that she was, she did give hints, more than hints, that she would marry. And I think this was a way, during her early years, of placating her ministers, because they thought, you know, you've got to marry. You've got to have a man's advice. You can't possibly, you know what to do with the country on your own. And so she, you know, agreed to receive the ambassadors of Eric of Sweden and various other rulers. But I think she once said, and again it's recorded, that she said, "I will have but one mistress here and no master." And she absolutely believed that. Good for her.
Okay, anyone else? It's Gordon, isn't it? Yeah.
Coming back on your last question, where did you find out where she said that about her not marrying?
I did most of my research in the British Library, and there's a fantastically rich collection of state papers all relating to the reign of Elizabeth, and she actually made that remark to her childhood friend Robert Dudley, who of course would be the man who was most rumoured to have taken away her famed virginity. I'll just give another plug for if you want to find out whether he did or not, then buy the book. Yeah.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Oh, that's. I'll come to Lucy. John, you're okay. Lucy.
Hi. You said that Mary, Queen of Scots, was more dangerous because she was in the castles in England, yeah. And she became more and more dangerous because she was in England.
Yeah.
Do you think it would have been better for her to have been sent into exile in France, or would she have become even more dangerous, in your opinion? Do you think Elizabeth made the best decision to keep her there?
I think Elizabeth had no choice but to keep her in England, but I think in a way it might have played to more Elizabeth's advantage if Mary had been in France, because she'd have been seen more as a sort of foreign princess, and as I said, the English didn't like foreigners in the Tudor period. And so the fact that Elizabeth was on home soil, she had such a strong claim to the English throne, really did make her a lot more dangerous. But Elizabeth was between a rock and a hard place, you know, really. What was she going to do? So the best choice that she could possibly achieve was to keep Mary under really close guard and close scrutiny. And it's quite interesting that even though Mary was on English soil for 20 years, Elizabeth never met her. So they have one of the most fascinating relationships ever in history, and yet they never met. And they nearly met on many occasions, because Elizabeth made a great show of going to visit Mary, and she always pulled out at the last minute. She remembered a prior hair appointment or whatever it was. And she always sort of stopped short of actually meeting Mary. And some say that there's been speculation that Elizabeth herself was afraid of falling under Mary's famous spell and being charmed by her. And she didn't want to be. She wanted to see Mary as an enemy.
A question down at the front, I think.
Thanks very much. My name's Andrew. I have several questions, so I have to tell you how I put the question. But the present queen is not descended from this queen of whom you speak. She is descended from Mary, Queen of Scots, and her relationship to Darnley and their son James.
So she's therefore distantly related to Elizabeth in that Elizabeth and Mary were cousins, but the blood of Elizabeth is much thinner than the blood of Mary, absolutely.
Do you feel that was a failure on Elizabeth the First part, not to secure the succession? A failure which neither Victoria nor Elizabeth have succumbed?
No, I don't think it was, because if Elizabeth had secured the succession by giving a direct heir, then she wouldn't have achieved greatness as the Virgin Queen. And really, you could see her dilemma, even if she didn't have such a personal antipathy to marriage. Who was she going to marry and not cause trouble? Her sister had already proved that a foreign prince would cause enormous trouble. And she couldn't either favour an English nobleman, because it was so faction-ridden in the court that then the other English nobles would have rebelled against her. So she didn't have a clear choice. And I think she did the best possible by sort of flirting with the idea of marriage, never quite committing to not marrying, but actually knowing herself that she never would. And therefore, and as I say, this whole kind of cult of the Virgin Queen, that's what she's known for, and that's what she's still remembered for in history. So I don't see it as a failure. I think it's probably about, you know, again, she was between a rock and a hard place, and she steered a sort of fairly successful middle course, I think. Thank you.
Okay, Chris.
Am I not right in saying, when you're saying about her being unwilling to marry, okay, was she not also affected when she was living with Catherine Parr,
yes,
about unwanted attention by an older man who I think was a brother-in-law, wasn't he?
He was an uncle, but Thomas Seymour married Catherine Parr with unseemly haste after the death of Henry VIII. Catherine had been in love with Thomas Seymour for many years, and so they married very soon after Henry died, and Elizabeth went to live with her former stepmother Catherine and Thomas Seymour, and Thomas very quickly became very attracted to the teenage Elizabeth, and there's sort of quite salacious accounts of him, you know, creeping into Elizabeth's bedroom early in the morning and tickling her. It gets a bit worse than that, but as I say, I'm not going to make it too saucy for a Wednesday evening, but again, there's been intense speculation as to the impact that had on Elizabeth, and indeed whether it went further than mere flirtation and tickling. And indeed, there are rumours of a child born to Elizabeth by Thomas Seymour. I do go into that in some depth in my book. But I think really that, yes, I think it had to have had a negative impact on Elizabeth, if for nothing else than to show the disloyalty that men were capable of. She adored her stepmother, Catherine Parr, and here was her new husband, Thomas Seymour, flirting with Elizabeth, and worse. And on another occasion, he was said to have cut her gown into 1,000 pieces while her nurse sort of held her down. So there's some very kind of dodgy goings on at Chelsea in that house after Henry VIII's death. So I think it can only have had a negative impact on Elizabeth, although it made her very wily and sceptical about how much one can believe what a man says, which I think was probably quite an advantage in later life.
Could you please tell us something about who supervised her education and,
yes,
what kind of education it was?
Yes, Elizabeth had an excellent education. She had a succession of very high-profile, well-respected tutors. And really, who was the most influential in Elizabeth's education was that final stepmother, Catherine Parr, who took enormous trouble to appoint the best tutors for Elizabeth. And certainly that sort of gave Elizabeth an excellent grounding in education, in languages. She could already speak about 5 languages by the age of 8. But Elizabeth was also, even though she responded well to her tutors, she was naturally very gifted. She was incredibly precocious, and it's quite common to read that about somebody royal, you know, they're terribly clever, of course they're going to say that, but with Elizabeth, really, I think my favourite example of how precocious she was is the fact that when she was just, as I say, 2 years and 8 months old when her mother was executed, and she's recorded as having saying, "How hap today but Lady Elizabeth, when yesterday I was Princess Elizabeth," and you think, like, you know, for a 2-year and 8-month-old, same age as my daughter, to come out with that, I mean, it's astonishing, really. She was incredibly gifted.
Perhaps we've got time for just a couple more questions. If anyone's coming. Okay.
Hi there. I know that Elizabeth was reputed to have come locally when she visited Thomas Vincent at Coombe House, mm-hmm, in 1602. That's just a year before her death.
Yes.
It just... she obviously must have travelled from Richmond to come here. I just wonder what she was like sort of health-wise, because you mentioned that she had rapid decline at the end of 1602. I just wondered how she was health-wise before that.
Well, actually, she was incredibly sprightly right up until the very last weeks of her life. It was said that she could outdance all her ladies. She continued to uphold a habit that she'd started in very young years of taking a brisk walk every morning before breakfast. She was very energetic. She ate sparingly, which wasn't the norm in the Tudor court. And she was incredibly healthy, incredibly energetic. And that's why you do see this marked decline. And it's almost, as I said, that moment where she sees herself in the looking glass. She realises that her power is fading. And it was said that, in fact, she made a conscious decision to die. She refused food or water. She remained standing. No, she refused to go to bed in the very last days of her life. And it was like she wanted to still be mistress of her own fate, even in the end. And so literally made the decision, it was said. And, you know, obviously she must have had, you know, serious health condition, but I think she certainly hastened her end if she didn't actually cause it. It's not recorded. She had a swelling in her throat, which made her breathing increasingly laboured. But, you know, the sort of descriptions are quite rudimentary, so we don't know exactly the cause. So that's why there's so much myth around the fact that she just decided to die. So she did. She defied God, you know.
One from each of you then. Tom and then Neil.
The succession to James I, was it clear-cut? Did Elizabeth know about it, and did she comment on it?
Elizabeth knew about it, but she literally left it till almost her last breath before naming James as her heir, because there were other contenders. You know, there were quite a few people of royal blood around in the early 17th century. But it was said that on her deathbed, as her ministers urged her to name her successor, and they said, "Will it be the King of Scots, Your Majesty?" And she sort of did that to indicate a crown. So she was beyond speech by this stage. So, yes, that was the moment when she recognised James. But I think quite rightly she left it till the last moment, because what happened in those days, when you named your successor, everybody flocked to them when it became clear that your own health was fading or that your power was loosening. So that's why she left it till the very last minute. But actually, he was the lead contender by that stage, so most people knew it would be him.
Last question. Thank you. Could you tell us a little about Elizabeth's faith in terms of her attitude to, you know, what had gone on before and what she was like in terms of her devotion and her Christianity?
It's really a good question, because Elizabeth is seen as just, you know, a very fervent Protestant, because she wasn't like her sister, who was a equally fervent or more fervent Roman Catholic. But in fact, she was more ambiguous in matters of faith than that, and she was forever emphasising that faith was a very personal thing. And so she didn't absolutely come out on one side or the other. And indeed, many of her closest friends were Catholics, or indeed atheists, actually. They did exist in the Elizabethan court. So I think she purposely left it ambiguous, although she was very devout. She had a strong faith, but what she didn't want to do was make it clear whether it was a very strong Protestant faith or a Catholic faith. And so it's quite ironic that she's kind of gone down as this great Protestant monarch, when in fact I think she had quite strong Catholic sympathies, despite everything that had sort of gone before. Thank you. Quite a fitting end, I think.
Yeah,
with a
good final question, Neil. Absolutely. Well, Tracy, we are hugely grateful. Thank you so much for being here this evening, and what we're going to do is the refreshments are still around. There's plenty more drink and food. Tracy thanked Anna Larkin and her helpers earlier. I'd like to express my gratitude to them. They've been working all day, so do make sure you eat up sort of all the canapés and drink all the drink before you go. And it was fabulous that lots of books got sold. We expected the books to be, you know, perhaps a few sold afterwards, didn't you? And loads have gone already. And so what I'm about to say now is a bit superfluous. But here are the other books that are on sale. Tracy isn't just an expert on Elizabeth I. This was Tracy's first book. I don't know why Henrietta Howard's head's been cut off there. She's not the wife of Henry. But the mistress of George II. And Tracy's first book was on Henrietta Howard, and that's on sale also here this evening. I've read all of these books, and they are really a fabulous read. And this one in particular, the detail on the resourcefulness and the instincts for survival
And the mark that Henrietta Howard left on Georgie in England is a fantastic read, so I really commend that to you. And another book on sale by Tracy, a more recent one, is equally exciting and readable. This one's on Matilda, the wife of William the Conqueror. And again, a fantastic read about the strength of character of this amazing woman and the influence which he had over the government of England. And then, of course, there's the crown of Tracy's books, Elizabeth's Women, which you've already had quite a lot of insight into this evening. And I'd just like to share, I've read all these books, and they are really fabulous. And what's great about them, as you'll find, those of you who've bought copies, is that these are scholarly historical books that read like novels, because they're so well written, and particularly fantastic at opening up the complexities of these characters and their motivations, so that by the time you finish reading these books, you really feel you know the subjects as real people. And I think a particular sort of gift for opening up women's history, telling the parts of history that perhaps have been rather too neglected when it's been so largely written by men. So I was going to say, you know, at a push, which one would you buy? I reckon you ought to buy all three if you're able to this evening. Although your book on royal weddings isn't here, is it? Tracy. Just decided to carry on the promotion. The other thing just to say before we move through to the lounge is if you've enjoyed this event this evening, it's been fantastic to have quite a few people here who are completely new to me. We may look to hold more events like this. And if you are interested in what's happened this evening and coming to similar things, out in the lounge there, just near the door, is a sheet of paper or a few sheets of paper where you can put your contact details. Email is very useful, but if you haven't got email, put down some other way that we can contact you, because we can hold sort of more events like this. And Tracy's got another book coming out fairly soon on a witchcraft trial during the reign of James I, haven't you? When's that out?
September next year.
And you never know, we might persuade her to do a book launch here at Christchurch. So that's pretty much it for the sort of formal part of the evening.